I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Our house is going to ruin, and that harms everyone, especially the poorest. Mine is therefore an appeal for responsibility, based on the task that God has given to man in creation, till and keep the garden in which he was placed. I invite everyone to accept with open hearts this document, which follows the Church's social doctrine.
Preparations begin for Pope Francis's Saturday funeral. We mark this Earth Day by looking at the Pope's climate legacy and his landmark 2015 encyclical that called for the world to make sweeping changes to protect what he called our common home. Then to the lawyer of Remesa Özturk, the Tufts doctoral student recently abducted by masked federal agents. A judge has ordered her to be transferred from an immigration jail in Louisiana to Vermont. Then 70 years ago this week, the historic 1955 anti-colonial Bandung Conference was held in Indonesia. We'll speak to Vijay Prashad.
70 years ago, 29 new countries from India all the way out to Egypt, from Africa and Asia, came to Bandung, Indonesia, to demand that a new world be built. I mean, what a glorious challenge to come and say, let's build a new world. You can't say they didn't try. They tried really, really hard. The fact that they didn't fully succeed has to do with neocolonialism, not with their ambitions. Their ambitions alive and well today.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A group of four Democratic lawmakers arrived in El Salvador Monday to continue to push for the release of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father who remains detained at CICAT, the mega prison where he was transferred and what the Trump administration admitted was an administrative error. The delegation was led by Democratic representatives Yasemin Ansari of Arizona, Maxine Dexter of Oregon, Maxwell Frost of Florida, and Robert Garcia of California. The group spoke from the capital, San Salvador. This is Congressmember Frost.
This isn't just about him. This is also about every single person in the United States. The Constitution applies to all people in our country. Due process applies to all people in our country. It's one of the things that sets our country apart from other places across the entire world. And so we're worried, of course, we demand the release of Abrego Garcia, but we're also worried about our own constituents.
This comes as the relatives of Venezuelan immigrants jailed at the Blue Bonnet ICE jail in Texas are fighting for their release after the U.S. Supreme Court temporarily blocked the Trump administration from expelling them to El Salvador's mega prison under the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. This is the brother of 28-year-old Jonathan Betancourt, one of the men at risk of being sent to CICAT.
My fear is that they might unjustly take him there because my brother is not a criminal. He just has tattoos. He's a barber, and tattoos are an art for young people, as well as coloring their hair. He has no criminal record, neither in Venezuela nor in the United States, thank God.
Meanwhile, a federal judge in Colorado may extend a temporary restraining order preventing Trump officials from sending two Venezuelan asylum seekers to El Salvador. The men are currently jailed at the Aurora ICE Processing Center. One of them came to the U.S. fleeing political persecution, while the other left Venezuela after two of his relatives were killed by members of the Tren de Aragua gang. But the Trump administration is now accusing them, without evidence, of being members of that gang. One of the asylum seekers has a single tattoo depicting his niece's name. The other has tattoos that include his mother's name, his birth year, and a character from the board game Monopoly. Here in New York, a group of students and alumni chained themselves to the gates of Columbia University Monday, demanding the release of Palestinian student activists Mahmoud Khalil and Mohsen Mahdawi. The two are in ICE jails, one in Louisiana, the other in Vermont, and fighting deportation proceedings after they helped organize Columbia campus protests in solidarity with Gaza. On Monday, Mahmoud Khalil's wife, Dr. Noor Abdallah, said she'd given birth to the couple's first child in New York while her husband remained imprisoned at the Louisiana jail over 1,000 miles away. ICE denied Khalil's request to be present at the birth. In a statement, Noor Abdallah wrote, quote, "My son and I should not be navigating his first days on earth without Mahmoud. ICE and the Trump administration have stolen these precious moments from our family in an attempt to silence Mahmoud's support for Palestinian freedom," unquote. Noor Abdallah is a U.S. citizen. Mahmoud Khalil is a U.S. green card holder until the Trump administration revoked that green card. Vermont Senator Peter Welch met Monday with detained Columbia student Mohsen Mahdawi, a green card holder from Palestine who was arrested in Vermont when he appeared for what he was told would be a naturalization test. Ahead of his arrest, Mahdawi helped lead campus protests against Israel's war on Gaza at Columbia University. Senator Welch, who's calling for Mahdawi's release, published a brief interview with Mahdawi he recorded inside the Northwest State Correctional Facility.
"I want to tell everyone that I feel so loved and so supported. And I am here in good hands. I am centered, I am clear, I am grounded, and I don't want you to worry about me. I want you to continue working for the democracy of this country and for humanity. The war must stop."
He was sitting next to Senator Welch in the jail as he spoke. A federal judge in Georgia has temporarily ordered the Trump administration to reinstate the visas of at least 133 international students. Judge Victoria Marie Calvert's order would, for now, block the termination of their student visas while their lawsuit resolves in court. A similar suit challenging Trump's mass cancellation of student visas has also been filed in New Hampshire. The news site Higher Ed Dive reports the Trump administration has so far terminated the visas of more than 1,550 international students, putting them at risk of deportation. Many of them have been targeted for participating in Gaza solidarity protests on campus, while others have had their visas revoked over past minor offenses like traffic infractions. Israel's military has killed more Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip. Al Jazeera reports Israeli attacks have killed at least 25 Palestinians since dawn, including 11 people who burned to death inside their home in Khan Yunis after multiple air attacks triggered a fire. Earlier today, the head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees denounced Israel's siege of Gaza, which is now in its 51st day. Philippe Lazzarini said nearly 3,000 trucks carrying life-saving aid and basic supplies are prepared to cross into Gaza. He wrote, quote, "Humanitarian aid is being used as a bargaining chip and a weapon of war," unquote. In Sudan, more details have emerged following a rapid support forces attack on North Darfur Zamzam displacement camp last week, with survivors describing mass looting and the burning of homes as bullets rained down on civilians. RSF fighters captured the camp, killing at least 300 people and forcing another 400,000 to flee as they face famine. These are two of the survivors.
"There were people who died on this road because of thirst and hunger. Some people just died. Now, I don't know what's become of my mother, father, brother, siblings, and my grandmother. I came here with strangers. Thank God I came with them."
"We are in need of everything a human needs, whether flour, rice, pasta, sugar, anything. Also blankets and covers to sleep on. We are sleeping on the bare ground."
RSF fighters have also reportedly placed checkpoints around Zamzam and other displacement camps in Darfur, leaving many without safe shelter or access to food and water. The Trump administration's cuts to U.S. foreign aid have exacerbated the humanitarian catastrophe, pushing thousands of civilians, including children, to the brink of starvation. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signaled he's open to ceasefire negotiations with Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky. It's the first time since the early stages of Russia's full-scale invasion that Putin has said he's open to bilateral talks with Ukraine. Putin's remarks came after another night of Russian attacks, including drone strikes in the Black Sea port city of Odessa, which reportedly injured three people and damaged several residences. The U.S. military is continuing its attacks on Yemen a day after Houthi media reported U.S. strikes killed 12 people in a market in the capital Sana'a. There were more U.S. attacks reported in recent hours in Sana'a, as well as the island of Kamaran in the Red Sea and in Yemen's central Ma'arib governorate. Houthi fighters claim to have fired on targets in Israel as well as on U.S. aircraft carriers in the Red Sea. President Trump's backing Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth after the former weekend Fox News host shared sensitive information about U.S. plans to strike Yemen in a group chat on the Signal app, this time with his wife and brother. It was the second such scandal in recent weeks. Speaking at the annual White House Easter egg roll, which this year was sponsored by Amazon, YouTube and Meta, Trump dismissed the reports as fake news and a waste of money. Secretary Hegseth also spoke to reporters, accusing them of spreading lies.
This is where we're fighting hoaxers. Hoaxers. This group, this group right here, full of hoaxers that peddle anonymous sources from leakers with axes to grind, and then you put it all together as if it's some news story.
The Supreme Court appears poised to uphold the preventive care provision of the Affordable Care Act as justices heard arguments in a key health care case Monday. This comes as the Trump administration's planning to gut public health programs in its new budget, imposing a $40 billion cut to the Health and Human Services Department. The administration's proposal, which must be approved by Congress, would also consolidate a number of health department functions under Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s new Administration for a Healthy America, or AHA. Among the proposed cuts are programs addressing gun violence, youth violence prevention, minority health and rural health initiatives. Connecticut Democrat Rosa DeLauro warned the Trump administration's proposal would, quote, surrender Americans to preventable disease and premature death, she said. Meanwhile, the National Institutes of Health announced it'll pull federal research funding from universities that have any diversity, equity and inclusion programs or are involved in boycotts of Israeli companies. Harvard University is suing the Trump administration after it froze over $2 billion in federal grants for the Ivy League institution. The freeze came after Harvard refused to comply with the White House's order on eliminating DEI, being involved with admissions at the school, and further suppressing pro-Palestinian protests. Harvard's president, Alan Garber, said the cuts would affect key research on pediatric cancer, veterans' health, infectious disease, as well as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. Garber warned, quote, the consequences of the government's overreach will be severe and long-lasting. The Education Department says it'll start garnishing wages and Social Security benefits for student loans that are in default starting May 5th. The policy shift could affect over 5 million borrowers, with another 4 million at risk of being in default in the coming months. It would be the first time the federal government would collect on the loans since repayments were paused in 2020 during the pandemic. The New York Times is reporting the Trump administration soliciting ideas from right-wing think tanks like the Heritage Foundation to help boost the U.S. birth rate. The proposals shared with the White House include a $5,000 cash payment after having a baby, ways to address infertility, and creating a National Medal of Motherhood for women who have six or more children. The so-called pronatalist movement is supported by Vice President J.D. Vance and Elon Musk, who has 14 or more children. The push comes even as the White House and the Republican Party are weighing cuts to Medicaid, which covers 2 out of 5 U.S. children. Democratic House Whip Catherine Clark responded on social media, quote, this isn't complicated. Number one, affordable child care. Number two, paid family leave. Number three, stop trying to slash health care for women and kids, unquote. The Vatican's announced the funeral for Pope Francis will take place Saturday in what's expected to be a scaled-down ceremony at his request. The Vatican says Pope Francis's death Monday at the age of 88 was due to a stroke and heart failure. We'll have more on Pope Francis on this Earth Day and his legacy as a champion of the environment after headlines. Back in the United States, a federal judge has issued a preliminary injunction ordering Trump's State Department to allow six transgender and non-binary people to obtain U.S. passports with sex designations that match their gender identity. For now, the order only applies to the six plaintiffs who plan to file a motion that would extend the protections to all impacted trans and non-binary people. The measure was among a series of anti-trans executive orders issued by President Trump on his first day back in office. The State Department since suspended the processing of passports for people who indicate their sex as X on their applications. In London, thousands of transgender and non-binary people, joined by their allies, gathered in Parliament Square over the weekend as protests continue following the United Kingdom's unanimous Supreme Court ruling declaring the definition of a woman does not include trans women who will no longer be protected under Britain's Equality Act. This is one of the protesters.
Cis people need to start rallying and understanding that transphobia doesn't just hurt transgender people. They are policing women, they're policing femininity, they're policing how we look. And we can't allow that.
And a clarification to our top headline. The Trump administration now says deported Maryland father Kilmer Abrego Garcia was moved to another prison in El Salvador after he was first held at the notorious CICAT mega prison. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The Vatican's announced the funeral for Pope Francis will take place Saturday in what is expected to be a scaled-down ceremony. In his will, Pope Francis asked to be buried in what he called a simple tomb at St. Mary Major Basilica. Cardinals around the world are heading to the Vatican for the funeral and then to pick the Pope's successor. Pope Francis died Monday at the age of 88 of stroke and heart failure. He made his last public appearance on Easter Sunday when he repeated his call for a ceasefire in Gaza. Today, on this Earth Day, we look at Pope Francis's long record calling for action on the climate crisis. On Monday, the top United Nations official on climate change, Simon Steele, remembered Pope Francis as a, quote, towering figure of human dignity and an unflinching global champion of climate action, unquote. In 2015, the Pope issued a groundbreaking papal letter, or encyclical, on the climate crisis, where he wrote, quote, "The climate is a common good, belonging to all and meant for all." The Pope openly criticized the role of wealthy nations in causing the climate crisis, writing, quote, "The idea of infinite or unlimited growth, which proves so attractive to economists, financiers, and experts in technology, is based on the lie that there is an infinite supply of the Earth's goods, and this leads to the planet being squeezed dry at every limit," he said. In 2015, Pope Francis made a plea to address the climate crisis when he spoke at the White House.
When it comes to the care of our common home, we are living at a critical moment of history. We still have time to make the change needed to bring about a sustainable and integral development, for we know that things can change. Such change demands on our part a serious and responsible recognition, not only of the kind of the world we may be leaving to our children, but also to the millions of people living under a system which has overlooked them.
That was Pope Francis speaking in 2015. We're joined now by Nathan Schneider, professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, also a contributing writer at America Magazine, a national Catholic weekly magazine published by the Jesuits, where he's been covering Catholic engagement with climate change and the economy. Nathan Schneider, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's beautiful to see that mountainous backdrop. As we once again talk about the Pope, who died on Monday, he was the first Latin American pope. He was the first Jesuit pope. If you can first, before we get into the environment, talk about the significance of his reign.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be with you again. Pope Francis's papacy is a historic moment in the time in the history of the church, something that I hope will be a beginning rather than now in his passing an end. It was a return in many respects to, I think, the heart of the gospel and the heart of the Christian message, which is simplicity and humility and a call for peace and for love and solidarity among people.
And Nathan, can you talk about the significance of his encyclical on the climate and this critique of what's accepted wisdom in modern society, that economic, technological advancement and economic growth are the key to nations being prosperous?
Absolutely. You know, when I first read this document, Laudato Si, when it came out, I remember tears coming to my eyes because of the force of the way in which he brought together the riches of Christian and Catholic tradition to bear with the prophetic work of social movements around the world in confronting a global crisis that we're facing, and that so many of the elites in the world we live in today are determined to ignore or, outright worsen. His message was, again, drawing on the prophetic messages of social movements, recognized that the climate crisis is not merely an environmental crisis. It's not merely about the things other than the human. It is deeply intertwined with justice in our human world, and justice for the poor. The poor are the people who suffer the most from climate change, and the wealthy are those who are most responsible for perpetrating it. And so this idea that is central to the encyclical, the idea of integral ecology, is about insisting on that connection, insisting that justice with the earth, our relationship with the earth, depends on justice among people, and that in order to address this environmental crisis, we need to also address the crisis of disposability, of treating not only the planet but each other as disposable, and that when we see these two together, we actually recognize not just that we've been bad, that we've done bad things, but actually there are so many things we can do. One of my favorite lines in Laudato Si is this exclamation he makes that truly much can be done. And he says that because he'd been watching social movements around the world, building cooperatives, building economic alternatives, using renewable energy, building sustainable alternatives to the dominant paradigm. And so it's really a document of hope above all. And it's that hope that was his overriding spirit.
And I'm wondering also, much has been made of the fact that he was the first pope from the global south, but he was also the first Jesuit pope. And could you talk a little bit in terms of the history of the Jesuits within the Catholic Church? Of course, historically, they were expelled during the colonial era, the early colonial era, from the Americas.
You know, the Jesuits have a long history, but from throughout that history, they've been a missionary order, going to the far reaches of the world, and in the process, learning from the world. One thing that Pope Francis talked about a lot was the peripheries. trying to turn the church outward to learning from the experience of people, not just in Rome, not just in Europe, but in Latin America, in the Philippines, in the places that that are often most vulnerable to the injustices of our world. He brought people from the Amazon to share their wisdom and their experience with faith in Rome. And so over and over, he was seeing the peripheries as a source of truth, not just the center of the church. And that is a kind of outgrowth of this long legacy of Jesuits going out to the far reaches of the world, learning the cultures that they found themselves among, and developing a kind of respect, developing an understanding of the Catholic faith that is not just one person talking to another, telling another what to do, but actually learning from our encounter with one another, recognizing that our faith is an experience of ongoing revelation.
I want to go back to Pope Francis in his own words. He spoke to CBS host Norm O'Donnell last year about the climate crisis. His remarks were voiced over.
El cambio climático en este momento.
Climate change at this moment is a road to death. A road to death, eh? And it is an artificial climate change, no? Something provoked, not the normal climate change, right?
You have placed blame on wealthy countries.
In great measure, yes, because they are the ones that have more of an economy and an energy based on fossil fuels that are creating the situation, right? They are the countries that can make the most difference, given their industry and all, aren't they? But it is very difficult to create an awareness of this. They hold a conference, everybody is in agreement, they all sign, and then bye-bye.
So that was the Pope several years ago. When President Trump saw him, he saw him only once, I think it was in 2017, the Pope presented Trump with a copy of that climate encyclical from 2015, very much interpreted as an attempt by the Pope to encourage Trump to take on the issue in a different way. Of course, the mantra of the Trump administration is drill, baby, drill. And the Pope is very direct about the connection between capitalism and the destruction of the environment. Can you elaborate further, Nathan?
Absolutely. You know, and I think it's really important to, you know, see these two figures together at this moment where we're losing one and one is very much on the rise. You know, one thing that Francis was deeply concerned about was the building of walls. Building walls higher, which was, of course, Trump's initial platform in coming to office back in 2016, 2017, and continues to be the kind of logic of his approach to governance. Francis wrote, for instance, another letter in 2020, Fratelli Tutti, calling for people to find solidarity across lines. He saw capitalism and militarism and the militarized borders as all part of a common turn away from the solidarity that we are called for, the love for one another that should be our aim, even if we can't always practice it perfectly, to at least make it the aim in our lives. And he saw the outgrowth of migrant crises in Europe and in the United States, where people are seeking migration just to be able to have a chance at life for themselves and their families, as intertwined with a climate crisis that is driving people to move from one place to another. And he called over and over for an approach to our politics in our own countries built on solidarity, as well as a solidarity that crosses borders. In many respects, I think he was an iconoclast in the sense of taking down the idols of our world. The idols, the things that we think are real that really aren't, the borders that are built around imaginary lines, the rules of capitalism that encourage us to privilege financial returns over human good and the cry of the poor, as he so often put it. So for him, the Christian message is above all a call to take down the idols and to see the opportunities for love and for solidarity that are actually right in front of us.
Nathan, briefly, the issue of his encyclical on climate being directed not just at members of the church.